I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. A 35-second cell phone video of a Puerto Rican Day parade in Philadelphia in September went viral. It showed Philadelphia Police Lieutenant Jonathan Josie striking a woman named Ada Guzman, knocking her to the ground and handcuffing her. Josie was later charged with assault, fired from the police force, and was just acquitted of the charges. The video and the verdict have divided the city and have raised questions about the use and misuse of evidence captured on phones and cameras. In a different case, the ACLU of Pennsylvania has filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of a Philadelphia resident who was arrested for using his cell phone to record an arrest. The police reportedly erased the video. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios to talk about all of this and what it all means. David Rudofsky is a civil rights and criminal defense attorney practicing public interest law with the firm of Carey's, Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg. He's a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. I should say his firm is involved in this ACLU lawsuit. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Jerry Ratcliffe. He's a professor, chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University, directs the Center for Security and Crime Science at Temple. He's worked with a number of police forces, including the Philadelphia Police Department, and for 11 years he was a police officer in London. And Jerry Ratcliffe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hello, Marty. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you both back. And I know you were on together talking about something else. But David, I'm going to put this to you, and then Jerry, I want to put this to you as well. When you look at that video, and I've looked at it about 25 times, what do you see?
Well, I think what you see, at least from the video, and of course we don't know what happened before the video started and what this officer thought happened, but whatever that might have been, I don't think you can excuse what the officer did. He turns around. He may have believed that this woman had thrown something or whatever, but he couldn't have seen it, and he strikes her. Well, if he thought he had cause to arrest her, he could have arrested her. I just, in my view of what happened, there was no justification for basically a sucker punch to her as he turned around.
Let me turn to you, Jerry, and let me say to our listeners that we have posted that video on our Facebook page and on our home page, so listeners at home can look at that as well. But when you see that video, what do you see?
I think most people agree that it's very much a disturbing incident, and it's had considerable negative repercussions for public perception of the police department. And I think you saw those concerns evident with the police commissioner moving quickly to place Lieutenant Josie on leave with intent to dismiss, and the district attorney pressing charges as well. But I also think, like a lot of people, I was very surprised by the outcome of the court case. And I share some of the concerns that people have raised about the independence of the judge in the case. Even if you review the evidence and the witness testimony impartially, it's not just an issue of justice being done, but justice being seen to be done. And so I have concerns about the judicial impartiality as essential in matters such as this.
Explain what you mean there, because there's some very specific concerns that you have about the judge.
The judge in this matter is married to a police officer, and people can marry whom they like obviously. But the judge has also been endorsed by the FOP. And the FOP had many members in the courtroom. And, you know, many of those members will be supportive. People see this video and they see it from their perspective. And what I think has been interesting here is the difference in how public perception has pretty much seen the video uniformly. But some members of the police department have seen it from their perspective as if they were in that sort of position. And so what we see are these differing views on how to interpret what would appear to be simple, just a video piece of evidence, but we see it through a particular lens.
And David, Judge Dugan, that's the judge we're talking about, said this is not a social media contest. This is not a trial by video. And again, we're talking about something that's 34, 35 seconds long.
Well, that's right, and it's a little inexplicable. It may be there's other evidence that you want to consider. It may be that there's other views of what happened, but you have clear, direct evidence, which, ironically, the police and the prosecutor use all the time to convict people. I mean, people are convicted based on video evidence, whether it's at a machine taking out money or whether it's somebody's camera or whatever, a cell phone. I mean, that has convicted many, many people properly because we now have unbiased, right, pretty direct evidence of what happened. There can be explanations. And so for this judge to say, well, this is not trial by video, I'm not quite sure what he meant. And to back of what was just said, not only was his wife, it's fine for his wife to be a police officer, but the reports were she was in the courtroom as well. So it just gives you a bad taste, a bad justice in Philadelphia.
But as you mentioned at the top of the show, we're talking about a slice, 35 seconds, and it would be interesting. It doesn't exist that that I know, to see what that incident looked like if someone else at another vantage point took a video of what happened.
No, absolutely. And I don't think anybody is saying simply because a slice of video, whether it's 20 seconds or 30 seconds, shows something that when you first look at it, you think, well, that's the end of it, right? We know what happened. There can always be explanations. There could have been things that happened before, maybe things that weren't picked up by the video. So I think we have to be careful in a world in which so much more is being captured by video, directly or indirectly, before we jump to conclusions. On the other hand, it's pretty strong evidence.
Mm. What do you think, Jared?
I think this is identified problems generally within the criminal justice system. This is a rapidly moving new technology. And the processes within the criminal justice system are really not set up for understanding how best to use this. You know, questions that I'm thinking about are, how do we incorporate cell phone video into the evidential process? As David says, what we are seeing is something from an external perspective. We're not seeing the incident unfold as it does from the viewpoint of the protagonists. We're not necessarily seeing the wider context or the background. We see what's taking place just in that snapshot of information. So at that point, you have concerns about how much weight should rest on the video evidence. Now, of course, with regards to CCTV, the police have often used CCTV effectively in prosecutions. But I think this has highlighted problems with how the implications for the daily operation of policing, investigations, and prosecution in the judiciary, and how to use video evidence. And I think we're lagging behind the technology in our system.
But do you think, David, and both you and Jerry were talking before the show began about the fact, and I think if you live in a city, you see cameras, and we live in a world filled with cameras. But do you think the fact that people do have cell phones could somehow balance the relationship between the police and the public?
I think very effectively. Not only there are obviously cell phones being used to record incidents between the police and the public. We've got cameras all over the place that also record things. But we were talking earlier, several of the police departments around the country, and England started this some time ago, are now arming their officers with these cameras. They're either dashboard on patrol cars, or I was just saying in Albuquerque in the last year, every officer now wears a small camera on his hat. So all these incidents are being captured, I think, to the good of everybody. I think that will deter police from acting inappropriately in those situations. It'll give good evidence for people who are acting inappropriately on the other side. So all that's good. But it's interesting, on this question of how much weight we give to the video, there was actually an interesting Supreme Court case a couple of years ago involving a lawsuit by somebody who was injured in a chase by the police. He was being chased. There was a video of the entire chase. He claimed the police at the end used inappropriate force and pushed him off the road. He was paralyzed as a result and sued the police. And there were differing versions about what happened. But as I say, there was a video, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 8-1 that video, independent of everything else, established that the officer acted properly. Mm. And throughout the lawsuit, notwithstanding different testimony by different people. And later, and just saying, look, this is clear. We're going to post it up on our website. This is clear. There was a study done later on how people viewed that video.
Yes.
And kind of predictably by race and class, we had a much different take on whether people thought that was an appropriate action by the police or not. So a court taking that issue away from a jury is problematic.
Kind of a Rashomon effect, would you say, Jerry, that the people look at an incident and can possibly take away something very different?
Well, you see two people looking at the same incident. So, for example, the public might look at it and see the perspective of the lady in the video and think, that's not great. Imagine if that was me. Police officers might look at it, and there is no uniform view amongst police officers, but some officers may look at it and think, you know, that's wrong, and he's made a mistake there. But who in a 30-year career doesn't make some sort of a mistake at one point or another? And unlike, if we're watching television, what we have is the capacity that incident is unfolding in real time with a lot of there's a lot of good interesting research about stress and blood pressure levels of police officers in high stress incidents. So that incident is unfolding really quickly over a matter of a few seconds for the police officer. And I'm sure a number of officers are looking at that thinking, that was a mistake, but it could easily be me in that situation, and my career and my livelihood and my pension and my reputation's on the line for a matter of a few seconds over a 30-year career.
But do you think the fact that there is so much more video, cameras, cell phones, that people will behave or do behave differently knowing that they could be recorded? And if we're talking about the police, that if they know there are people in a crowd and this is a chaotic scene, if you look at this video, that they actually behave better or differently?
I think there's a sense of inevitability about the change taking place with this. And I think, as David said, I think it's good for everybody. The Police Executive Research Forum recently did a survey, and they said that 62% of the agencies said they plan to increase in-car recording capacity, so much so the technology is going to be in more than 80% of police cars in the very near future. And so I think that's we'll see a generation of police officers entering the police service now, just with an understanding that video will be just part of their day-to-day lives. And generally, police officers have been initially cautious about this, but once they've had video and it's a part of their daily routine and it becomes a sense of normal for them, they've often seen the benefits, not just that with the case, the Supreme Court case that David mentioned, but all sorts of things. There was a recent incident in Austin, Texas, with an officer-involved shooting, where a 16-year-old burglary suspect was shot after aiming a gun at an officer whilst fleeing a store. The camera in one of the cars captured the whole incident, and the police were able to use it to quell public concerns, and they were able to show members of the community the video. And it really helped in terms of balancing what can be an initial knee-jerk reaction after something like a police-involved shooting of a member of the community. So there were a lot of pluses from it.
David, let me pick up on something, and let's say there's a police officer with a stellar reputation. He is caught one day making a mistake. You know, I mean, doing something reckless. Does that one captured incident then undo a stellar reputation that we don't have video evidence of? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
No, for sure. I mean, but I think that's a question that goes to the disciplinary process, right? So for a police commissioner then who has to decide, right, this is an officer, 20 years, no problems, right? He's done something that seems reckless. What do I do,
yes,
right? Is there a suspension? Is there a retraining? Is this serious enough that he deserves to be fired, right? I mean, remember, the members of the public are held accountable. We prosecute people all the time who are very good people and do something criminal. And they go to prison for it. So it's a balance. But I do agree that within a department, a police commissioner has to, you know, think through that in determining that. I think this commissioner made the right call, regardless of his history. When you look at that video, unless there's some explanation, which we don't seem to have, which would justify punching out this woman when you could easily have just arrested her, I think it's hard to disagree with the commissioner's action.
I need to take a short break only because the clock is telling me I have to do that. That's David Rudofsky. He's a civil rights and criminal defense attorney practicing here in Philadelphia, the firm of Carey's, Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg. Also with us, Jerry Ratcliffe, and he's a professor chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University, where he directs the Center for Security and Crime Science. We're talking about a particular video that went viral, a video that captured a police officer striking a woman at a Puerto Rican Day parade in September in Philadelphia, and talking about all the various police and criminal justice questions that video raises. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 156.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
Musicians tell us they often feel pressure to conform to the latest trends, but for reggae soul singer Itana, success has come by staying true to her vision.
I'm not concerned about what category they put me in. I'm concerned that they get to hear it and understand it.
Itana tells us about her latest album, Better Tomorrow, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about a cell phone video footage of an altercation happened in September at the Puerto Rican Day Parade in Philadelphia. It went viral. It showed a police officer striking a woman, knocking her down, and handcuffing her. The officer actually was arrested for assault. He was fired by the police department. The mayor apologized to the woman, and a judge recently acquitted the officer, saying this is not a trial by video. This case has raised a whole host of questions involving video and the police. And we've been talking with civil rights attorney David Rudofsky and Jerry Ratcliffe, who chairs the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University. We have posted that video on our Facebook page and our homepage. You can check it out at whyy.org/radiotimes. And joining us now is Timothy Lee. He's a Philadelphia-based reporter covering tech policy for Ars Technica. And Timothy Lee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me, Marty.
And I'm going to begin with you with the same question I asked David and Jerry, which is, when you look at that video, that Josie Guzman video, what do you see?
I mean, it's certainly, as I have said, it seems hard to understand why he would have done that. And I think it's the sort of thing that 10 or 20 years ago, you might have had an incident like that, and the citizen would say, you know, this police officer hit me, but she might not have had any sort of recourse, and now, in many cases, there's video available to either confirm or refute those kinds of accusations.
There was a Grant Fredericks, who was quoted in an article in the New York Times, in the Philadelphia Inquirer about this case, basically saying video can be edited, it can be altered, that it can be changed so that what we see is not really what happened. Is that how, looking at this video, do you see that, and is that possible to do without being detected?
Well, I mean, sure, certainly it's theoretically possible, but as in any other case where you have evidence like this, the question is, you know, who would do this and what would the motive be? And I don't know the details of who took this video, but it was far enough away that I assume it was someone not connected with this woman. And so it would be pretty strange for someone to, sort of stage this sort of thing or completely fabricate. So it doesn't seem, in most cases, I think that this kind of video is significant evidence of what happened one way or the other.
And do you see this particular case as part of a larger issue or even other cases in other cities or communities around the country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've seen a lot of cases around the country where, that you have allegations of police misconduct and the video is available to prove or disprove it. And there's been a lot of cases where police officers have tried to intimidate citizens or confiscated their camera to try to prevent them from doing this kind of video. And we've had some litigation about whether police officers are allowed to do that.
You also wrote a piece about the D.C. Police Department head who basically said to her officers that the public has a right to videotape you as you were working, just the way the press does. Can you explain or expand on that?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And like, so the courts have been pretty clear that the public does have a right to do this kind of recording in most cases. If it's a public official operating in public, the public has a right to make videos under the First Amendment. There's been a couple of courts, one in Massachusetts, I think, and one in Illinois that have said that. And what happened in D.C. was that the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the D.C. For an incident involving a cell phone camera. And as part of the settlement, the D.C. chief of police was agreed to issue this new policy that made it very clear that the police have this right. I mean, they probably already had it under the Constitution, but it's helpful to have the police chief saying so explicitly.
Timothy, let me get our guests in on the conversation. I'm going to toss that first to you, David Rudofsky. Does the public then have a right to record?
Yes, I think that's becoming established. There were mentioned two federal courts have already held that, both that there's a probably a First Amendment right to do it, and that certainly the police cannot arrest you for recording what they do unless you're literally interfering with their public duties. And to the commissioner's credit here in Philadelphia, Commissioner Ramsey has also instructed the department here along the same ways as the Washington, D.C. Police Department and has told them don't erase, don't seize it, don't arrest people for exercising their constitutional rights. So I think police chiefs around the country are getting the message, police officers are getting the message, and hopefully we will see much less of what we've seen a lot of, where the police are trying to destroy evidence that may implicate them in misconduct.
You want to weigh in on that as well, Jerry?
Oh, David's right. The police commissioner has made it very clear to officers in Philadelphia that video, people recording video is perfectly reasonable, except as in the circumstances, as David says, when they're directly interfering with the activities of the officers. And that can sometimes be the case in very dynamic events taking place in the street when people are best to sort of step back a little bit. But, you know, Kathy Lanier in Washington, D.C., and Commissioner Ramsey are really much ahead of the curve in terms of many of the police chiefs in the United States. And I think it's going to take a while for this sense of understanding how this new technology feeds into the day-to-day operations of government and policing before it becomes normalized.
And Timothy, I was talking with Jerry and David about just the fact that we live in a world filled with cameras, and as someone who covers tech policy, can you just add to that? Then we're going to have to say goodbye to you, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation, but just I guess that we all should be super aware of the fact that there's a good chance someone is taking our picture doing something somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about the presidential campaign last year, you know, Mitt Romney with his 47% comment that got a lot of discussion was the result of, I think, a waiter or somebody pulling out their cell phone camera. So, you know, I think in general it makes public officials more accountable because, you know, whether or not they see a camera, they are sort of aware, I think, that somebody might have one, and so they better be on their best behavior. So I think overall it's a positive development.
Well, Timothy Lee, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a Philadelphia-based reporter covering tech policy for Ars Technica, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation and continue my conversation with David Rudofsky, a civil rights and criminal defense attorney here in Philadelphia, and Jerry Ratcliffe, chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University. And again, we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we have posted this video that we've been talking about on our Facebook page and on our homepage, and you can check it out at whyy.org/radiotimes and call in and tell us what you see. David, I just want to ask you something because we've been talking about the use of videotape in a courtroom and, you know, how much evidence or how strong that evidence is. But one thing I think that we have learned in the last couple of years is that eyewitness testimony is surprisingly questionable. And I wonder just to sort of add another element to our discussion, how we use videotape and compared to eyewitness testimony.
Absolutely. I mean, when we look at the exonerations from DNA, we've had 300 exonerations. In 70% of those cases, it was bad eyewitness testimony. And I think there are two points to be made. One is that eyewitness testimony, unfortunately, is often not correct, and not that people are lying, but they simply
they misremember.
Yeah, they misremember, and we're learning much more. There've been a lot of studies done as to why that happens, but it really focuses on this video in a different way. Not so much that you might have a video of the incident, but what we're learning is that videotaping the eyewitness process, whether it's a photo spread or a lineup, better ensures that that is done properly and we can see if there are flaws there. And equally important, many departments are now moving towards videotaping interrogations. Normally, we have a swearing contest, right? The police say one thing, the suspect says another. There is no reason, there is absolutely no reason with our technology why we are not videotaping every confession. Again, from the DNA exonerations, over 20% of those exonerations involved false confessions. Persons who falsely confessed to crimes they didn't commit, often with details of the crime that only the suspect would know, which the police had fed them. There's a swearing contest. Obviously, they were all convicted. A judge or a jury believed the police. There's no reason when we have this technology, When police investigate crimes, whether it's labs, whether it's lineups, photo spreads, or interrogations, why all of that is not videotaped.
Does that make sense to you, Jerry?
It does, and I think it's going to help the prosecution process. And again, this is one of those areas where there will be a degree of reluctance because people are generally reluctant to change. But in the end, areas that have moved to this, my background is in British policing where interrogations and interviews, and even the custody suite is being permanently recorded. And so people come into that knowing that's the situation. And officers have adapted to it very quickly and actually embraced it. It's prevented unwarranted accusations against the police officers and complaints that haven't had any justification behind them. But people will often do that because they think it'll help them get out of the trouble that they've got themselves into. So in the long term, this is definitely a plus for policing. There'll just be a period of time where it becomes normalized. And then I think we'll see that there's an improvement in policing and in professional standards. But also this will help the police department.
But is the resistance just, I don't want a camera in the room, or, they're asking me to do something else? I mean, does it feel burdensome or intrusive?
Well, I think there's a sense of people being concerned about what are the implications if they make an innocent mistake. And we see different aspects of that in society. If you think about the National Football League and the NFL, they've brought in video replay as part of their processes. And you think about the capacity for human beings to make mistakes. A line judge running down the side of the pitch, is pretty much all his job is to see, did the player catch the ball and land in bounds? That's all they have to do, and they're a couple of feet from it. But week after week, we see them making mistakes. Mm. But that mistake gets reviewed in slow motion from different angles that the line judge never sees. And also with the calmness that we have all sitting at home with a beer in our hand. So at that point, we can sit and pass in minute, pretty much frame by frame, what's happening. And so the decision-making of the process that the line judge took was pretty much instant as the whole thing unfolded within a second or two. So I think there are some concerns about how much will decisions made in very short periods of time when there's a lot of adrenaline running through one system will be passed and used to blame officers. I think that's where some of the concerns come from. I don't think they're warranted in the long term, but it comes back to what David was saying earlier, which is, the discipline system and the process, the adjudication process has to weigh up the long-term career of pretty much fine officers as we have in Philadelphia against making a mistake.
Well, and I wondered, David, and I promise I will get to our callers, but that, let's say there's a video of an interrogation. Who gets that video? I mean, is it filed away? Is it used as evidence in court? Does it go up on the internet? Is it?
Well, you certainly have to be careful on that. Certainly, it can be used as evidence in court if the suspect says, look, I was intimidated, I was coerced. I think what the police are finding from these videos is that they can use it to rebut that. On the other hand, if there was something untoward, and I think we're not talking about the very close call about whether that tennis ball was in by an inch or out by an inch, we can live with that. But if there really is inappropriate action, we'll see it, and we won't have the swearing contest where how do you make that decision? So I think there, and I think Jerry's absolutely right, police officers who initially resist this in departments in which it's been implemented really like it now, and I think it's beneficial to everybody.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Bill from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. And Bill, go ahead. You are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My comment in question, I'm a Philadelphia-based attorney, and looking at the video, it seems to me I certainly have a clear take on it, but I'm wondering from the panelists what they think the long-term impact will be of this decision when you're dealing with citizens in Philadelphia that already, to some degree, feel like their rights are not heard and officers are put at a higher standing when they're giving their testimony. I'm wondering what their thoughts are on the long-term impact and whether there'll be any outcry from the citizens or the legislator or the judiciary. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jerry, you want to take that? I mean, I guess time will tell. But nonetheless, do you think this is an issue and a verdict that has some life?
Well, I think it does, but generally the whole issue of videotaping these incidents, you know, when you see on the television and or you listen to the radio and you hear that discussion of an incident is about to take place in the news in 10 minutes' time, you pretty much know it's not going to be good. And, you know, Philadelphia Police Department, as an example, interact with hundreds of thousands of people every year. And, of course, the vast majority of those officers behave professionally and ethically. But, of course, if people have video of that, it doesn't exactly go viral on the internet. Mm. So there are issues here about how much one or two videos, one or two unfortunate incidents can have a negative implication for the public perception of the police that seems disproportionate. There's a degree of research that suggests that when people have a negative interaction with a police officer, it needs anywhere between 5 to 10 positive interactions, sometimes more, just to get their perception of the police back up to the level that it was at for that one incident. So it's not a one-for-one trade-off, and I worry that now that we have the capacity for millions of people to see one small incident involving essentially one officer, that has a negative fallout for the perception of how people see thousands of officers who are otherwise professional and very ethical and doing their best to try and make the city safer.
Does that concern you, David?
Yeah, no, I think Jerry's right. I think actually the real problem with this incident to me is less the perception of the police, but I think that it feeds the cynicism about the judicial system, which faced with this kind of evidence. You have a judge says this is not trial by video. Well, what is it? And again, I said before, it may be that when everything was reviewed in this case, you might say there was not criminal conduct here. Whatever was going on in his mind might not have been criminal. A jury or judge could make that determination. But I think given all the factors that we've looked at, it does feed this cynicism. And I think that's a bad thing for the city.
Can I ask you about this ACLU case? Your law firm is involved in this, and as I understand it, the ACLU of Pennsylvania filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of a Philadelphia resident. He was actually arrested using his cell phone recording someone else's arrest. What do we need to know about this particular case?
Well, this was an incident that happened before Commissioner Ramsey told his police department, look, people have a right to do this recording. It was during a period of time when, unfortunately, police, without much direction or supervision, were doing this more than once.
Taking away cell phones.
That's right. They didn't want their actions recorded for one reason or another. That's our allegation in this case. So this is a case simply for damages for this one individual. Hopefully, the new directive from the commissioner in the Philadelphia Police Department and other places will make this unnecessary in the future. We're hopeful that police will now be able to live with what is pretty clearly the law of the land.
Well, and as I understand it, the police allegedly or reportedly erased whatever was on the camera?
That's right. And we've had over the years many complaints of this happening. And in fact, we've had situations where they've tried to erase it, they weren't able to, you know, so we've had situations where the technology shows what was going on. Again, it's not every officer. These incidents tend to become, well, if it happened here, it's probably happening every day in every incident. We're not saying that. But even a couple of these are troublesome.
So police should not or cannot or shouldn't erase information on a cell phone camera. I'm looking at you, Jerry.
No, the commissioner.
Just to underscore what David was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. The commissioner's made a directive about this. And he's right. You know, unfortunately, a couple of incidents shouldn't happen. But now with modern technology, we're being influenced by, you know, incidents that happen in other places. And that can affect how we feel about police in our city. You know, how much did this incident affect the public who were, how do they feel about the police in Oakland, California? The BART shooting in Oakland, the death of Oscar Grant at the hands of a police officer in the BART system in the public transit system in Oakland, California. How much does that now affect how we feel about the police in Philadelphia? The change in technology is changing a great deal at a very fast pace, and it's difficult to know what the ramifications are.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Jerry Ratcliffe, chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University, where he directs the Center for Security and Crime Science at Temple University. He was a police officer in London, and he has advised a number of police departments, including the Philadelphia Police Department. David Rudofsky, a civil rights and criminal defense attorney practicing here in Philadelphia, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Designer, Craftsman, and Historic Home Shows, March 8th through the 10th at the Valley Forge Convention Center. Tickets online at historichomeshows.com or 800-826-3893, extension 2209.
Nobody expected Mike Piazza to make it in the big leagues, but he became a 12-time All-Star. On the next Fresh Air, Piazza talks about his life in the game, being inaccurately outed as gay, and getting a clubhouse call from Roger Clemens after the pitcher beamed him.
I was not in the mood to talk, so I basically told him where to put the phone.
Join us.
Today at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The U.S. Department of Education tweaks its qualification standards and unexpectedly cuts off some loans to thousands of students at historically black colleges. Also, treating and preventing PTSD by studying the warrior brains of Navy SEALs. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
PICO supports WHYY. The PICO Smart Business e-Audit is an online tool that analyzes and estimates business energy usage and provides customized recommendations to help manage energy consumption. Find more at pico.com/smartideas.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about some cell phone video footage of an altercation at a September Puerto Rican Day parade here in Philadelphia. It went viral, showing a police officer striking a woman, knocking her down, handcuffing her. Just to recap, the officer was arrested for assault, in fact, fired by the police department. The mayor even apologized to the woman, but a judge recently acquitted the officer, saying this is not a trial by video. And we're talking about this particular case, but also the growing number of cases involving video and the police, and the fact that someone is probably taking a picture of you right now. Our guests are David Rudofsky and Jerry Ratcliffe, and we're taking calls at, you said I don't make mistakes, I just did. and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'd love to know what you make of this particular video, but also this whole question of the fact that there is the relationship between the police and the public and the role of cell phones in that relationship. Let's get Peter from Princeton to join us. And Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I have the general question I have is, what sort of training is involved for police officers in terms of handling high-stress situations where they have to make decisions on what force might be necessary, whether to continue a high-speed chase, or whether to use a taser, or whether to use a club, or how to restrain, you know, when what response is appropriate, what training do they have at the police academy, and what training do they have sort of as an ongoing basis to help them with those decisions so they can make the right decision?
Jerry, thanks for the call. I'm going to toss that to our Jerry guest here. Go ahead.
That's a very good question, Peter. And I think the issue very much is, irrespective of what level of training you have, how well does that training replicate the circumstances you're likely to encounter on the street? There's an interesting research done by actually a former Temple PhD from our department, Matt Hickman, who's a professor in Seattle, who put heart rate monitors on a police officer. Now, driving a car isn't a high-stress kind of activity, and the resting heartbeat of the officer was evident throughout much of the research, until the officer was involved in a short chase of a drunk driver. Now, at the point that the officer got out of the vehicle and had to draw his firearm, the officer's heart rate was hitting 165. And that's pretty much adrenaline-driven. Now, there's no circumstances that you can replicate at the police academy that would give you a chance to even come close to that type of scenario. So you can replicate the scenario, but you can't necessarily replicate the emotion and the intensity of that situation. And so it's very difficult to find ways to provide that sort of level of training. I used to do riot shield training, public order training, and I've had police officers throw petrol bombs at me. That actually hit me and surrounded me with petrol that was on fire. But at any point in time, I knew there were half a dozen people standing around with fire extinguishers. Anybody could have yelled stop, and we could have gone for a cup of tea. So however hard you try to replicate that circumstance, you're not really preparing officers for dealing with the chaos and for the emotions and for the adrenaline that fuels people in those circumstances.
But taking this incident, what about a kind of a debrief after this incident, using that as a teaching tool? And clearly, when you look at this video, it's a chaotic scene. Apparently, there's some people doing crazy things in cars. A lot of people milling around, and it feels chaotic and a bit scary.
Absolutely. And I think that incidents like this and many others are available. They're often, unfortunately, I think, used to examine decision-making, but less to examine within policing how to manage and deal with the stress. A lot of the stress about police officers has found that the most stressful times, again, with heart rate monitors are when they're dealing with offenders. There's even, in some cases, anticipatory stress, where people have stress before they even come on to work at a shift. And that stress doesn't really dissipate till after they've gone home. So it's, you know, we don't have those sorts of levels of stress in our job. You know, I'm an academic. So, you know, it's hard to now translate from my former life as a police officer to this change. It's very difficult to find a way to change those circumstances.
Indeed. Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
You know, I think that's all right. It's a very good question. And it also, I think, points to the need of a department not only doing the proper training, but supervising certain situations so that officers are not put in a difficult situation. Let me talk about two.
Yes.
High-speed chases, which kill more people than police use of firearms every year in this country, and often innocent third parties. You have these high-speed chases, and somebody's car hits somebody else, and somebody dies tragically. Police departments are starting to realize that, and a good police department monitors those chases and calls them off in advance when they shouldn't be going on. So if it's some minor crime and we're going to find this guy anyway, don't chase him at 90 miles an hour through a school district, right? And that's just asking for disaster. So take the decision out of the hands of somebody who's under extreme stress and maybe thinking, well, do I chase, do I not chase? And have a supervisor make that decision. We'll save lives at really no cost. Same thing in dealing with a lot of the police shootings that cause a lot of problems with the public are shootings of persons with some kind of disabilities, mental disabilities or otherwise, hostage situations. We now have specially trained units to deal with those people who don't aggravate the situation, know when to go in, when to stay back. It doesn't mean we're going to have perfection. As opposed to an officer who's not trained in that situation and who may aggravate it and use force kind of peremptorily, don't let that happen. So there are actually some situations where we can actually in advance control the outcome a little better and not deal, and Jerry's absolutely right, with the kind of pressure that people feel even in a short chase of a drunk driver. We don't have to get into that. Obviously, there'll be some situations where we can't control it, and we hope the training does it and supervision does it, but we're learning more about that, I think.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, and Philadelphia has one of those programs for dealing with people with mental health issues, a crisis intervention team, which is officers trained in a variety of the districts who have had additional training in dealing with those types of incidents. So this is a learning process for police departments, and you know, in some areas, Philadelphia is actually doing very well nationally.
Mm-hmm. Let me get, looks like Jerry from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Jerry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, what this video shows me is that there's two sets of laws in Philadelphia, one for police officers and one for citizens. If I had been videotaped striking a officer, there would be no doubt that it would be trial by video. We had a case in Northeast Philadelphia where an officer assaulted a woman at a convenience store after his son struck her car in an auto accident. That videotape was the property of the store. Three or four other officers showed up about 10 minutes later and demanded from the store manager that he surrender the videotape. Mm. I think officers use videotape when it's convenient for them in their cars, but when that other people produce it, that's not desirable.
Jerry?
That's not a situation. Yes.
No, I just had a question, and then I want to hear from both of our guests here, but that incident at the convenience store, when did that happen? I'm just curious.
I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago. The Daily News does a very good job of documenting these incidences, far better than the Inquirer. And it's really, I live in Philadelphia, it's become sickening to the point where almost every day I open the Daily News, and almost every day there is a case of an officer assaulting somebody and immediately charging the victim with an assault so that at a later time they can work out a deal.
Well, Jerry, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I should say that the Daily News won a Pulitzer Prize for their investigation into several incidents, and they did involve cameras in convenience stores. But is Jerry right, David, that there are two sets of laws in this city?
Well, there's certainly at times a strong feeling that we've got a double standard, both in terms of how evidence is viewed and how we view the actions of police officers versus civilians in assault situations or others. Obviously, everybody knows historically there have been situations of cover charges. An officer does something wrong, they charge the civilian, hoping that we'll just kind of, you know, deal the whole thing out at the end. That's a function of police work all around the world, unfortunately. But I think the underlying question has some force. I think occasionally we see it. I think we saw it with the trial this time. And he makes a good point. I mean, the other video thing, because I think the officers for years in Philadelphia have tried to avoid being videotaped. The case he talked about that the Daily News covered a couple of years ago, I was involved in some of those cases where they had suspicions that some convenience stores were selling plastic bags so that people could sell drugs. There were searches. Most of these stores had surveillance cameras, and the officers in every one of those cases, or in a lot of them, disabled the surveillance cameras, so nothing that they were doing would be seen. That's destruction of evidence. It shouldn't go on. Hopefully we've learned from that. But this notion of a double standard is one we've got to take seriously.
Sure.
I think one of the issues that came out from me and for a lot of people is issues about the outcome of the court case. It, as David said earlier, it may be that the judge reviewed this in an impartial manner, but it's the perception of impartiality of the judge. And coming from overseas, coming to Philadelphia 10 years ago, I've been in systems where judges don't have to seek elections. They don't have to be embroiled in that political situation. They don't have to seek endorsements from police organizations. So now you have police unions endorsing judges. And from an overseas perspective, it just seems incomprehensible how that's the system of how we run things.
Land of giants.
Land of giants. Jerry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Max from Philadelphia has to say. Max, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'm a student at Drexel Law School, and my question has to do with Askia Sabour, who was found not guilty on the 19th of February of charges that resulted from his beating by the Philadelphia police, who the DA's office did not charge with assault. What had theoretically began as a would-be citation for obstructing a sidewalk turned into a rather brutal beating, which was filmed by a citizen. That beating turned into an arrest for disorderly conduct, which in the end turned into five charges, including disarming a law enforcement officer. As opposed to Ms. Guzman's situation, Askia Sabour's trial did turn out to be a trial by video. And during the trial, the question came up as to the matter of how police officers' stories changed from when they made their initial reports to the times after the video footage arrived on YouTube, etc. So my question is, what can police departments do to prevent such retellings of the story that end up looking dubious to juries and lead to not guilty verdicts?
Well, and Max, just so we understand how the story ended, and what was the verdict on this case?
Askia Sabour was found not guilty. Five charges related to resisting arrest in general.
And your question is using this story as an example, you see changing testimony coming from members of the police department?
Right. From when initial reports are made and don't make any mention of trying to disarm a law enforcement officer, and then YouTube video of a citizen's beating comes out.
I got you.
The story's changed from when those initial reports are made to when they testify in court, the police.
Max, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I guess, Jerry, if I can put that to you, it seems like something we've been talking about during this hour, which is that if you have videotaped testimony or evidence, that, in a sense, forces a consistency of story if you're going to stick to what's in the video.
Oh, it does, and we would hope that in the vast majority of interactions in Philadelphia between the police and the public, that there's no issue with that. I think the issue here is how to deal with this change in technology. The commission has moved forward with a change in policy that's made it clear to everybody at least what the policy of the police department is. But there's also change by experience. And the more and more videotaping happens, the more officers have videos in cars, the more officers in some police departments, I believe in Austin, Texas, they're actually buying their own cameras, small pinhole cameras, $30, $40, and officers are using those themselves. The more this becomes normalized, then a change in a change will take place by experience, not just by policy.
David?
Yeah, and I think also just picking up on the relating of that case, it also points to the need for prosecutors, right, to be looking at that. I mean, they may be getting one version from the police. They see a video on the other hand. Maybe that's a case that shouldn't even been brought criminally, right, so the police charge them. But, you know, you step back and you look at it and you say, well, it doesn't square, right? We're not going to go ahead and prosecute that case, which sounds like maybe that's what should have happened in that situation.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller on. We have, looks like Tony from Ardmore. And, Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. What's to prevent the police when they videotape an interrogation or what's been videotaped from the police car to alter that tape once it's all done? And that's very easy to do.
It is easy to do, but I think it's also easy to detect. But let me see what our guests have to say. Jerry, I'm tossing that to you first.
Well, let me give you an example of a police department that has in-car video. Their processes are such that one police department has fairly sophisticated in-car video, but it's not actually possible for the officers to interfere with the video. It gets uploaded to a cloud with no interaction of the police officer, and it gets stored. And that's done to preserve the impartiality and to preserve the quality of the evidence. So there are systems that can be put in place with the use of technology that would actually prevent officers interfering with the tape. And that has benefits for the officer, and it also has benefits to aid the prosecution.
But what I hear in Tony's call, David, is a suspicion of the police.
We always have it. Remember the Nixon tape and the gap, right? Look, I mean, is it
that was many years ago.
Right
though.
Now, is it technically possible? Sure, we know it can be manipulated and so on. But I think Jerry's absolutely right. We also have the technology to prevent that, and I think it's hugely risky for an officer in most situations to try to change the tape, manipulate it, erase it. The cover up is usually worse than the original offense.
We're almost out of time here. Both of you teach at local universities. Is this a teaching? Is this stuff that you're teaching, David?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, criminal procedure, evidence, the world gets changed by technology, both in how not only police act, but judges have to deal with it, lawyers have to deal with it. It changes things.
Same for you.
Stress decision-making in policing, but also the implications of new technology right the way throughout the whole criminal justice system. There are ways to use this and other incidents in very up-to-date teaching techniques.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today once again on Radio Times discussing this very important issue. Jerry Ratcliffe, a professor chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University, where he directs the Center for Security and Crime Science. David Rudofsky, a civil rights and criminal defense attorney here in Philadelphia. He's part of the law firm Carries Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg, and he's a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. You can also view this video that we have been talking about. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.